All right, as we begin our study this morning, we are in the second journey that Paul has taken as he's moving through the regions around Macedonia and over into Achaia, up in Greece, effectively, establishing churches and working with the people there. He had a small group that he started out with when he crossed over the into Greece. He and Silas were the first two that were going. Who else did they pick up along the way? Two other names that keep coming up here. Timothy and Luke. Luke is the guy who's writing this, right? So he's the historian that's going along with them. Last week, we looked through their journey, and they kind of started out in Philippi, and we had a couple of people there that were very famous in terms of people knowing them very well in the scriptures. But we kind of keep in mind when they were done in terms of along this journey. They were some of the first ones that were met. Two. Who were they? Okay? The jailer, for starters, don't know a name, but it's Philippian jailer and his household. Who else? Lydia. Okay, so, and then he goes from Philippi and moves over into Thessalonica, and they work in the synagogue there for a while. They're converting some people, but kind of an uproar and gets run out of town there. But we find that he sent Timothy back, okay? So Timothy is gone, it goes back and forth. And what we'll find is this group, as we kind of look at Paul as the central character as he's moving through these places, it's not that the whole group winds up going with him. They're kind of coming and going during this time, and it's kind of hard to keep track of exactly who's where at each instance. But we'll see a little bit of that as we look at some of the other like letters to the Thessalonians that he's going to write very shortly here. So they move down, and from Thessalonica they go into Berea. They have great results there. Another well-known verse where it talks about the Bereans were more noble. What did they do that was more noble-minded? Yeah, they searched the scriptures. In this case, it's the Old Testament scriptures that they're searching to make sure that they understood that what Paul was teaching was, in fact, what God had intended. You know, a lot of them were Jewish. They had a very deep background in the Old Testament laws, and you know, you can understand their desire to make sure that they were getting it right if this is going to be this big a change. So Paul then moves on down. He's on his way kind of out because he's getting run out of town effectively. And he winds up in Athens. And the other folks are sent back out to other places. And so he's kind of by himself in Athens. And last week we looked at his address up on Mars Hill where he got a chance to talk with the Epicurean and the Stoic philosophers. And to me, that's just kind of an interesting picture to see the Apostle Paul as a well-learned, well-educated, he's a rabbi in a lot of ways if you look at what he would have been prior to being a Christian. And he understood Greek thought, having read and studied that, because he's quoting some of their works to them. And he's in there arguing with these other people over pretty esoteric points in their philosophy, until they get to a certain point where they talks about the resurrection of the dead. And to them, that just kind of was I'm sorry, you know, I can bend, but I can't break. That's just nonsense, and a lot of them went off. But it says that some of them believed. And very tail end of chapter 17, it says, but some of the men joined him and believed, among whom were also Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. One of the interesting things about this name, Dionysius, is we really don't know much else about it in the Bible, but there's a guy named Eusebius who wrote some church history and wrote down a lot of things that happened in the first couple of centuries. And in his writings, he mentions that this man became one of the elders there at the church in Athens. So we can see that the church had a start there as well. But Paul is still trying to get to the centers where he can teach and he can preach, and he moves on beginning in chapter 18. It says that after these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he came to them. And because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Okay, so as he goes to Athens, one of the things that we talked about last week And we looked at some of the verses that in some of his other writings that talked about this. What did Paul do in between Sabbaths a lot? He worked, okay? Paul is, in many ways, having to support himself on this journey. This isn't just a, I've got a big bank account that I can, you know, take drafts off of someplace. He's working his way along. Now, there were times when others supported him, and we looked at times when folks from Philippi or folks from Thessalonia sent to his aid, and we'll see that in just a second, one of those instances. But in the main, he had to work if he was going to eat. Now, that doesn't mean he wasn't also preaching in other places and doing other things in the week, but primarily he had to work to earn his living. And as he's doing this, God's helping to provide for him even in that, isn't it? He comes to a strange city. He doesn't know if he's going to know anybody there. Who's the first people he runs into? Aquila and Priscilla. Now, this is a Jewish couple. We don't know from this point whether they were Christians at this time. They might have been, or they might not have been. We don't know. We know that they are later because he keeps mentioning them as the church that meets in their house. And they're now in Corinth. They came out of Rome. Why would they leave Rome? What does it say happened? Yeah. The Claudius got tired of some of the shenanigans the Jews were pulling there in Rome, and as one of the good scapegoats, he just decided to kick them all out. Well, he didn't exactly do it that way. If you look at the phrasing of his decree, it simply says that they're not allowed to practice their religion inside of Rome anymore. So if they wanted to stay and not be arrested for practicing their religion, they had to kind of quit being Jews is what it amounted to. So a lot of them just left. And they went to other Roman provinces because this decree wasn't across the empire. It was just localized. It was just there in Rome. And so they've come down there, and oh, they've got a business there, and they happen to be the same trade as Paul, and they take Paul in, and he works with them. Now, a tent maker doesn't always just make tents, okay? That was kind of the description of the trade. They were workers with leather and workers with canvas and things like that. So, yes, they made tents, but they also made coverings for things and awnings and, you know, just all kinds of stuff that would have been made out of leather and canvas. Would have been part of what they were working at as a trade. Now, you don't think of Paul as being that kind of a person. He's the preacher, right? And he was studying in Jerusalem, and he was studying under Gamaliel. But that was very common during that time. Not only would they have studied and learned, in that kind of situation, but they would have also had a trade. He would have grown up with some sort of trade. It's kind of hard to think of it that way sometimes, isn't it? I mean, when you think of Jesus, it's hard to think of him in a way of holding a hammer and a saw. And yet, as he was growing up, that would have been one of the things that as a young male growing up in his father's household, he would have learned his father's trade. So even he would have had a trade. So, Paul is working, and he's going every Sabbath to reason with again with the Jews, and who else does it say there? It says Greeks. Okay, so primarily this is that God-fearing Greeks that we've read about before. These are still not necessarily people who have become proselytes, but they are at least meeting with and studying with the Jews who are there. They believe in God. Some of them may or may not have been proselytes, but the point is they were familiar with Jehovah God, with the Old Testament scriptures, and with the things that were associated with living that way. That's important from a standpoint of what else he's seeing as he goes around. As he preached in Athens, what was the thing that really got under Paul's skin when he was at Athens? The idolatry, right? The gods and the idols and everything that were just all around them. But you know, folks, Athens wasn't just the only place that had that. Every one of these cities that Paul is visiting, and Corinth, when he gets there, is just like that. They had multiple temples up on the hills to various gods. In fact, it was quite a central location for idol worship in many cases. And so that's another reason this group kind of stands out, is these were people who had effectively already given up idolatry, and now that's his first fertile ground to start bringing them in to this new fold into Christ. So as he's preaching and teaching with them there, they're having some success with them. And then in verse 5 it says, but when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. What is it that's going to give him the ability to completely devote himself to the word? They're going to bring funding, right? So now he's got some extra way to help provide for himself, and they can now working full time. So you can see there's not just a magic formula that says this is the way you got to do it. They did it whatever way they could. When he had funding, he used it and was able to preach, you know, more. When he didn't, he worked and did what he could. But he's dedicated on this trip to trying to spread the gospel into a lot of these major cities. So, when the Jews, however, resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads, I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And then he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God, whose house was next to the synagogue. And Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household. And many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. And the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, "Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking, and do not be silent." So Paul has been working here with folks, but you know, you got to think about his, the reaction he's had. How has his reception been in other cities up to this point? Okay, he's been stoned once. That was on the first journey, right? So, and he's been tossed out of, Philippi. He's been in jail and out and run out of Thessalonica and run out of Berea. And, okay, we're not doing real well in terms of his ability to really hang around. Now, I don't know what it was that made Paul the center of this attention, but that clearly seems to be the case, because even when he is run out, we see examples of him sending Timothy back or sending Silas back or sending some of these others, and they continue to work. But under severe conditions, the persecution in these other churches was ongoing, as we see from his other writings. And I want you to look over in 1 Corinthians, the second chapter, because prior to this vision, I think Paul, when he was talking about his work with them there in Corinth, made an interesting statement. 1 Corinthians 2, beginning in verse 3, he says, let's start in verse 1. It says, "And when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom proclaiming to you the testimony of God, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God." That gives you a little insight into what's going on here when Paul is first coming to Corinth. You know, we don't think of Paul as being one who's afraid and weak and that kind of thing, but that's what he's saying. He said, when I was first starting out there in Corinth, what was my attitude? He said, I was afraid. I had fear. I had weakness. And I think that's part of what's being addressed in this vision there in Acts 18. What is the vision telling? Don't be afraid any longer. I like that because, in a way, it makes Paul more human, doesn't it? Sometimes when we look at the Apostle Paul, he's one of those that transcends humanity in a lot of ways. I mean, he wrote most of the New Testament. He was a brilliant man. And we look at him and say, how could we possibly live up to that kind of example? But when you start looking at him as a person, he had many fears too. And he had a lot of things to overcome. But did he let that stop him? See, there's the difference between Paul and a lot of people. Some people are afraid, and that kind of that puts the brakes on whatever they're going to do, whatever they're going to teach, and how they're going to go. Paul said, I was afraid, but I taught anyway. And in fact, if you think about what he's saying there in 1 Corinthians, the second chapter, when he says, I didn't come to you with wisdom and all, did he try to persuade them with great flowery speech like a lot of the other philosophers would have done? He said, no, I came to you with a simple message, Jesus Christ and him crucified. But did he have things that would persuade them? He said, I came to you demonstrating the power of the Spirit. Now, what I get from that is that he was working miracles there among them. Things like healing people. Things like when we've seen already along the way him casting out that evil spirit that was in the young lady. Those kinds of things Paul was still doing. And yet, even with that, he's afraid because there's a lot of people against him. We're going to find all through Acts that this persecution against those who were trying to change the status quo was very heavy. People are always afraid of change. That's just common. You know, when you want to change, there are people who can accept it and other people who are afraid of it. And Paul knew that, and he's trying to work as gently as he can with them, but there comes a point where there's just a message that's got to get out, and that was Jesus Christ and him crucified. So as he's coming there, he's emboldened with Timothy coming. He's emboldened with this the message that God gives him in a vision that he doesn't have to worry anymore. And so he winds up moving in to a guy that's right next door to the synagogue. Now, that had to be kind of an interesting piece, too, because he's teaching there, and he's had some good results. He's going to wind up having to not teach there anymore, but he's living right next door, effectively. I get from that, this is kind of the Jewish quarter. Just like it would have been in a lot of cities, and just like today, when immigrants or whatever come into a place, if you notice that they kind of settle into a common area. Why is that? Why is that? Yeah, they like to be around people like themselves. It's a comfort thing. It's a security thing, okay? Who do you trust when you're in a new place? Well, at least if you've got some links with people that you know kind of who they are and what they are, you've got some trust that you can develop there. So Paul's effectively moving into the Jewish community, even though he's trying to reach out outside of that to the Greeks and whatnot, and the others that are there. But he says, I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in the city. And he settled there a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. Now, yeah. Well,
is
I think what he's saying is, what if you'll notice what he's done primarily at every place up to this point, he has gone to the synagogue first, converted what he could there with the Jews. He was converting Greeks all along, but typically it was ones who were already familiar with the word there. I think what you see here is where he's now really reaching out. You think he would have refused to teach a Jew that came up and said, I want to study? No. But what he's doing there is he's saying, I've presented it to the Jewish community now. My focus, my effort is now going to be to go out and push this outside of these boundaries. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's a famous statement that they made right when they were asking for Jesus to be crucified. That's exactly the statement they made was, you know, his blood be on our heads, right? Well, Paul's kind of turning that around on him and saying, okay, his blood is on your heads. Now, I don't see in that, it's a hyperbole. It's a statement that says basically, I'm done with trying to really do my best with just this group. We're moving on. I'm going to teach everybody and everybody that I can come across at this point, especially with the extra support that he gets. That's why he settles there for a year and a half. Corinth is an interesting place. I wish I had my map up. It's on that little isthmus that separates two large land bodies that kind of stick together with a narrow piece, right? Nero, a few years before Claudius, had tried to dig a canal across there because it was a real impediment to shipping. And in fact, they had this stone-lined dredgeway that ships would come up and dock on one end. They would unload them, drag the cargo across the isthmus and load them on the other side because it was faster to do that than it was to sail all the way around the thing for all the ports up in that region. What that did mean, though, is Corinth is a pretty wealthy city. Anytime goods go flowing past a city like that, what do the city governors do? You tax it, right? It's a transit tax. So there was a lot of wealth in Corinth in a lot of ways. A lot of people that were there from all over the world. It was a real melting pot in that area of the world. So he had plenty to draw from in terms of people and nationalities and languages, just all kinds of things that would have been there for Paul to take advantage of as he's trying to teach the gospel. So, yeah, good point there. I mean, he makes a statement, I'm tired of this. We're going to go out and teach the others. It still wasn't exclusive. You still find Paul interacting with Jews on a regular basis after this. Sure. A little late. Corky, in case you hadn't heard Corky, he was saying that statement that he said, no one will attack you and harm you, seems a little late in the trip here. I think there could be any number of reasons behind that. God's already shown that he's with Paul, but Paul's had to suffer a bit. One of the things that's a little tough as we look at this, and especially even today with people that like to preach, we kind of call it the health and welfare gospel. As long as you're, doing what's right and you're really, trying to follow God, then the result will be everything will be hunky-dory, right? And that's kind of the story that you see in Job. When things weren't going right for Job, they would say, what have I done? Not me. I don't deserve this. That's never been the way with God's people. And we've always understood that even though you can be a follower of God, does that mean bad things never happen to good people? That's the problem with Job. That's the story of Job, is that bad things can happen to good people. There's just an extra level of protection that's fixing to come up here. He's going to have plenty of travails again. But he's just saying, while you're in Corinth, you've got this extra measure of protection. Part of it, I think, is for Paul. He's got to learn to just keep working through what he's got to work through. I mean, when he asked to have his thorn in the flesh, whatever that was, taken from him, that was denied because God was telling him, my grace is sufficient for you. I don't know if Paul, if he had enjoyed perfect protection and all of these things had been granted, if he'd have gotten so arrogant that he wouldn't have been a good teacher. I don't know. But whatever it was, God felt like that's what he needed to keep going. I think that's a scary thing in life, too. Sometimes we get what we need from God, and it may not always be what we want. And that's a difficult lesson for a lot of us to deal with. Yeah, and the time period of when he started this second journey until he gets to Corinth is probably on the order of 6 to 9 months, somewhere in that time frame. And then he's going to spend a year and a half there in Corinth. So he's spent maybe months or two since these others, but this one's going to be longer. That's a good point. As he was one of the persecutors for a while, and now he finds himself on the other side of that coin, being persecuted by his very own people. Even to the end, Paul considered himself Jewish. A lot of people miss that in a way, but when he's talking to people and he says, "You want to talk about being a Jew? I was a Jew, right? I'm a Jew. I'm from the tribe of Benjamin, and I was the strictest according to the sects, and all of these things." So it wasn't that becoming a Christian meant you had to completely lose your Jewish identity. And that's no different than today. Sometimes we have the feeling that in order to become a Christian, you have to then conform to whatever Christianity looks like in your particular corner of the United States. And there are variations and differences in cultures and things around the world that fit very well into Christianity simply because they're in areas where it doesn't talk about exactly how you do things or whatever. And that's okay. And Paul is making use of that here as well when he's working with these new people. We have to keep in mind, a lot of this is based on what's coming up from Acts 15. Remember when we were looking at Acts 15? There was a big issue there of whether or not they had to be circumcised to become Christians. Keep that in the back of your mind as you're looking at Paul's interaction with a lot of these Jews. In a lot of ways, Paul was not really fighting to just eradicate Judaism. What he was trying to say was you didn't have to be a Jew to be a Christian. You could be, that's fine, but it didn't require you to convert to be a Jew to be a Christian. That would have been the message that would have really gone foul with a lot of the Jewish groups that he started interacting with on this trip. Because then as he's inviting the Greeks and the other foreigners in, the non-Jewish people in, to become part of that community, he was not requiring them to be circumcised and to, you know, follow the old law and to, you know, do those kinds of things. And that's where some of that friction would have come in. So he probably was accepted at first by folks, and then as they began to hear the message more clearly, it was like, no, wait a minute, you know, that's not what we were thinking. And so you get that interaction there between those who wanted to maintain a very strict way of life, that all anyone belonging to God was going to have to be Jewish first. So as he's working there, they start to try to stir up trouble again. And this is where you see, I think, a little bit of that protection that God said in the vision coming about. Gallio, when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat, saying, "This man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I am unwilling to be a judge in these matters." And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Okay, so we got to understand the picture here. In the past, in these other places, like if you remember back in I think it was Thessalonica or in Philippi both, when they got Paul in trouble with the authorities, the Jews may have instigated it, but you notice they always collected other people, the townspeople, things like that. And part of the claim would be, he's teaching us that we don't have to follow the idols anymore. He's turning our city upside down. He's teaching against the culture that we have. All of these things that they would talk about had something to do sort of with the empire and trying to get Paul in trouble there. And they would kind of pull people in to help them. Notice who's coming here. It says the Jewish leaders brought the charges forth. They're getting pretty good at this, and they're thinking, we can just bring these charges ourselves. Unfortunately, they picked the wrong guy. This guy named Gallio, you remember we talked about the reason that Aquila and Priscilla were in Corinth to begin with, because Claudius had issued a decree for them to go out. Well, it turns out Gallio was a friend of Claudius. They actually dug up this letter. It's in out of one of the, in Delphi. They've got a fragment of it, where Claudius was writing to them, and he mentions the fact that his great friend, Gallio, who was proconsul, had informed him about some of the things that were going on there, and so the letter goes on, it's fragments, you know, to talk about it. But the neat thing there is that it's the emperor of the time, Claudius, mentioning Gallio, who is the proconsul right here, so it also gives us a nice time stamp of around 52 AD that this occurred. So 50 AD is when that decree came out. That particular letter was around 52 AD, so we know that's when he was proconsul. And when these people come up, the judgment seat would have been an open area. And again, had a picture of the forum there in Corinth. We'll maybe put them up next week real quickly. But there would have been the market stalls and things around, a big open area. And the guy would have kind of taken a small raised dais that he would have sat on. And they would have had his court clerks, which would have had the cases arranged to bring them forward. But this was a public thing. You know, this wasn't the closed courthouse off in the corner kind of deal. Anybody who wanted their entertainment for the day came out to watch all the judgments being done. So, you know, it was, you can imagine there's a bunch of folks around. And so the Jews, this group led by the leader of the synagogue there, stand up before him and they start to bring their charges. You know, that this man, Paul, and apparently are arguing against, you know, that he's not obeying our Jewish law. I mean, it talks about the law there, but obviously from what Gallio's saying, he's going, what? Wait a minute. I'm a Roman. You guys have a problem with your own little laws and things. You go figure that out. I am not taking my time here. And it says he drove them from the judgment seat. Basically, he kicked them out of his court area. So then what happens? Remember, we've got a big public mob standing by, right? And Gallio has just basically dismissed a group of Jews, saying he doesn't care about them. So what do you think a lot of the Greeks there did, as it says here? Like, ooh, here's somebody we can beat up on, right? And so they kind of just take this guy and start, you know, pummeling him. And you think Gallio doesn't see it? No, he sees it there. It's like, just desserts. Those guys brought a frivolous thing in front of them. Yeah, you know, just let it go. But after that, the Jews would have been very reluctant to make that kind of trouble for Paul there in Corinth. And so this protection that he was talking about, he says, you've got a job to do there. And now he's going to be there for a year and a half working with the people and helping them out. Sosthenes, right. Oh, yeah, because in verse 8, what does it say about Crispus? He believed in the Lord. Yeah, I think they're going to let him stay the leader of the synagogue when he turns into a Christian with Paul. Yeah. Exactly, exactly. So you wind up with, I think Crispus was there at first. He probably got turned out. You got Sosthenes that comes up. He winds up getting a beating over this. But at some point, he winds up changing over as well. So I think you've got two different people there. Crispus believed, and go on, there's no real connection that we think they're the same person. It's probably two different people. And all the leader of the synagogue was the... a synagogue was established in a city when there were 10 or more Jewish families together who would declare themselves to be a synagogue. They didn't even have to have a building or anything, okay? Then as you would get enough people to support being able to build something, typically the buildings were privately owned. I mean, they weren't public structures or, you know, part of a group. But they were a community there. And it wasn't necessarily whoever built or owned the synagogue that was the leader of the synagogue. That would have been almost like an elected position. It would have been one of the elders there that they would have gotten together and decided this person was the leader. And they were responsible then for organizing the worship service and things like that each day. So it did change over occasionally. It's not like one person would have been it for life or whatever. So we get an interesting picture there, don't we? He converts one, and then the second one decides he's going to take him to court. That doesn't work out well. And then we find out later when he writes to him that, in fact, he was converted as well. So, interesting story. Possibly so. I don't think necessarily so in Corinth. It's a small enough geographical area that typically they didn't put more than one where it was fairly easy for everybody to get together in one place. Archaeologically, they have found, I believe, one place that they think was a synagogue in Corinth. But I don't know that, we don't know. It's not likely that there would have been a bunch of them or anything like that. Even though it was a fairly good city, it's pretty compact. And for that day and age, thousands made up a good-sized city, not millions, you know, like we do today. A little different logistics in terms of how you supported a city there. Okay, so... Paul then has this support. He stays there for a while. One of the other things that we need to kind of keep in mind is that while he's at Corinth for that year and a half, he begins his writing. The letters of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians would have been written while he was here at Corinth. And you can imagine that he's wanting to communicate with that group that he had just started not that long ago. So that gives us a kind of a dating there of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. And in fact, turn over to 1st Thessalonians, the third chapter. I just want to kind of link in a couple of things here. So if you look at 1st Thessalonians 3, Paul was saying, therefore, when we could endure it no longer, we thought it best to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy, our brother and God's fellow worker in the gospel of Christ, to strengthen and encourage you as to your faith. So there we see that when Paul was in Athens, Timothy might have been with him for a while, but he sends him on back up to Thessalonica. And then if you pop down, he says, for indeed, when we were with you, we kept telling you in advance that we were going to suffer affliction, and so it came to pass, as you know. And for this reason, when I could endure it no longer, I also sent to find out about your faith, for fear that the tempter might have tempted you and our labor would be in vain. But now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us good news of your faith and love, and that you always think kindly of us, longing to see us just as we also long to see you, for this reason, brethren, in all our distress and affliction, we were comforted about you through the faith. For now we really live if you stand firm in the Lord. So we can see that Paul, even from the beginning, had these other churches on his mind. He's working that year and a half here in Corinth, but he winds up, while he's in Athens sending Timothy, he goes on down to Corinth. Timothy winds up coming down to Corinth to visit Paul, and Paul says, okay, now my mind is relieved. You know, I've heard that you guys are still carrying on. But you'll see in the whole letter of the 1st and 2nd Thessalonians that there's a bit of persecution that's continuing there. That persecution that started with Paul didn't end when Paul left. It's continuing on. And so Paul's got that concern. We also see from this that even though he had that protection in Corinth, that doesn't mean he didn't have any more hard times, that there weren't other ways that he was persecuted. That continued as well, kind of during his whole career as he's spreading the gospel through this area. Okay, so back in Acts 18, after this year and a half, it says, Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria, and with him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Cenchrea, he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. Let's just talk about that one for a minute, because that's another one that's difficult for a lot of people as we're looking at it. So Aquila and Priscilla are going with him. They're kind of heading back. They're going to wind up back in Antioch, and so they're just on that journey back, as you see the path that they would take. And it says when he stopped in Cenchrea, he cut his hair because he was taking a vow, or he had taken a vow. The hair cutting was at the conclusion of the vow. In the Old Testament, there's really only one vow that is talked about that had hair things and hair restrictions associated with it. Anybody remember what that one was? The Nazirite vow, okay? Now, a Nazirite vow could be taken one of three different ways. We see three examples of it. There was the vow for a term, which was when the person took the Nazirite vow, they said how long it was going to be. There were some standard intervals, but, you know, people sometimes did a year, sometimes did 7 years. But there was no fixed one. You stated when you were taking this vow how long it would be. It's a vow of dedication to God. That's really what it amounted to. At the end of the vow, okay, second one. What was the second one? Well, the second one was a vow for life. A person can come up and say, I will be a Nazirite for the rest of my life. And then they would embark on that. What was the third one? Well, before you were born, we have a few people that were dedicated as Nazirites from birth, right? We know three of them in the Bible. Two in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament. Who are the two in the Old Testament? Samson? Lived at the same time. Two Nazirites at the same time. Samuel. Samson and Samuel. Okay? And then in the New Testament. John the Baptist. Okay. Now, at the end of that vow, which, of course, if you're taking a lifetime vow or one of the from birth kind of things, there is no end to that one, they were supposed to shave their head. Now, in Numbers, the sixth chapter, where it talks about this, they were to shave their head at the temple, and that became part of the dedication. Their hair was actually burned as part of this finishing the vow thing. So a lot of people look at this and say, well, since he's cutting his hair in Cenchrea, then that couldn't have been a Nazirite vow because it's supposed to be done at the temple. Well, it turns out that if you look at the Mishnah during this time period, people took similar to Nazirite type of vows and included this the part of being shaving their head when it was finished. But it was possible, and I had a quote, and we'll get it up there next week if anybody's interested in it, that you could have multiple people in a place that was kind of far from Jerusalem, and they would all terminate their vow at the same time, and one person would be responsible for taking everybody's hair back to the temple. So they could actually sort of by proxy have their hair taken back. So this may have been what Paul was doing. We don't know exactly, other than that's the only thing that makes sense in this, is that he had made a vow of dedication to God, which is what the Nazirite vow was and what the end of this thing would have been, and that for whatever reason it was terminated there. Now think about it for a second. I thought, we only got 5 minutes, so this is probably a good discussion here. I thought Paul was done with Judaism. What's going on here? I mean, Acts 15 said that didn't have to be circumcised anymore, so surely you don't have to cut your hair and all those kinds of things too. What's going on here with Paul? Paul's still a Jew, okay? We don't know anything about the vow that he took. I have my suspicions, okay, and this is just Ken Holliday's theory and just from reading through it. What was Paul afraid of? He was afraid of the various things that he was, being persecuted along the way. He had his mission he wanted to accomplish. When he took this trip, and it talks about them setting them aside and laying their hands on the church going out, as a Jew, it would not have been unusual for Paul to say, I'm dedicating myself to service to God for this trip. And so why would he wait until Synchrea to cut it? Trip's over, he's headed home. Now, he's not heading all the way down to the temple. Maybe he met up with others that, you know, had taken a similar vow and somebody's going down that way. We find later on that he's, again, accompanying people to the temple who are ending a vow.
Which temple are you referring to when you say
in Jerusalem.
Yes,
yes. He's wanting to head there, but it turns out that if we read the rest of it, he gets to Antioch, and then he turns back around to the third journey and heads on. So he may not know when he's going to get there or what the circumstances are. We just don't know. Luke is great with his brevity here, you know, just kind of putting these things off. But he gives us this point for a reason. And I think that's the reason I wanted to talk about it a little bit, is Paul was obviously keeping some sort of vow. It was a vow that involved dedication to God for a duration or a period. Don't know what was involved in his statement there, but we do know that he had set himself apart to do this trip and to then finish it for God. And that he is now thankful that it's, you know, things have worked. He's been out there. He's established churches. He's written some letters. At this point, folks, we've got at least the letters of 1 and 2 Thessalonians and Galatians that are starting to circulate. It's kind of interesting as we see this move through Acts of these gospel records of the things that are being written and the timing, and we'll kind of talk about that as we go on through, that they're starting to have the word that they can rely on. Yeah, so it's not a big deal. I mean, so for a lot of people want to make a big deal out of it. The reality is, it's not a big deal. He had taken a vow of dedication. Now, it was a big deal to him, but I just mean in terms of people were trying to, you know, wrap their head around, was Paul a Christian or a Jew? And the answer to that is yes. Absolutely. He's going to wind up in the temple, gets in trouble there as well, you know, even though he's trying to fit in as well. So Paul was trying to let his Jewish brethren know that he was still Jewish. He hadn't abandoned them. But what was he letting the Greek people know? When he was in Philippi, what did he declare to them? I'm a Roman citizen, right? So that's part of Paul being all things to all people. You know, he identified with people where he could.
And that does show us, you know, you can be a Christian we might frown on another culture, but you can be a Christian in many cultures, and you can have your own, you still can embrace your own tradition and be a Christian.
Yeah, and as long as those traditions are not contrary to God's word, then that's what we have to be careful of. You know, there are places and cultures where there's a lot of different things that are foreign to us. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're wrong. You know, we have to look at that at each place. Christianity at its core has very simple concepts and very simple constructs. And Paul delivered that very simply, even when he was talking to the Corinthians there. I gave to you what was of first importance, right? And I love that scripture because it tells you where the first importance is. And so he could establish that in multiple cultures as he traveled the world. And so we'll pick up there next week, heading back, and then there's just a couple more verses, and he starts on the third journey. So we'll get there next week.